Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, and Happy New Year. Welcome again to Your Cases on Hold. I feel like we just finished the holiday party at Nakatomi Plaza. It was amazing. And now we're back for a new year of cases that are still on hold. This is episode 49. We're now starting essentially our third year of doing Your Cases on Hold. So shout out to JBJS for surprisingly letting us to continue do this.
Listeners who keep dialing in, we've got more in store for this year for sure.
If it wasn't for the listeners, we couldn't keep doing this. So thank you for your continued support and enthusiasm. And if you're new to us, make sure you hit the like and subscribe, get the notifications, look at the back issues, visit our previous episodes. This is, if you're listening on the day this drops, it's January 2nd. And this is for the January 3rd, 2024 issue of JBJS. Your Case is on Hold is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. It's getting to that time where the deadlines are approaching for this year's testable sessions. So get in on that and get a 5 years worth of orthopedic education summed up in 5 days or something like that. It's definitely worth your time and sets everybody up for a lot of success. And if you've already done it, it doesn't hurt to come back and learn a lot of orthopedics in just a short period of time. The pace at which new science is being developed gets faster with every passing moment. So it's impossible to keep up on all of it. So let us do the work for you, right? Like you listen to us here, listen to the folks at the Miller Review Course, and make sure you're up to date and where you need to be if you're taking the test, or if you just want to update yourself on your orthopedic education. Your Cases on Hold are the opinions of myself and my colleague. They are not the opinions or ideas of the editorial board, the editor-in-chief, the board of trustees, and other members of JBJS Corporation. That being said, I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor of Methods at JBJS, and you are across the way.
Deputy Editor Antonia Chen of Adult Reconstruction.
So without further delay, let's get into the top of the pile. The orthopedic research year, he's not talking about the year coming up. This is the year of orthopedic research. It's talking about taking an orthopedic research year. Faculty mentors must hold up their part of the deal. This is by our editor-in-chief, Dr. Swinkowski. It is permanently free. Some very important insights about the two-way street that is orthopedic research in the training environment. Please do check it out. It's important for all of those who are interested in participating in research at the level of a trainee and for those who are sponsoring and mentoring orthopedic researchers in that context. And we have catastrophic sports injuries, causation and prevention by Bowden. Then we have a near miss in clinical outcomes research data collection, a M&M type report around clinical research by Brandon Erpin colleagues. And we have a research year for medical students by TID, AOA critical issues, competence and leadership to meet the challenges of a new normal, AOA presidential address, Salt Lake City, Utah, June 15th, 2023 by Van Heest, permanently free. Using a modern linked research database to examine gender disparities in orthopedic grant funding from 2010 to 2022 by Harris and colleagues, 30 days free. And now some news from our headlines. My chosen paper from this issue is Non-Fusion versus Fusion Surgery in Pediatric Idiopathic Scoliosis. What trade-offs and outcomes are acceptable for the patient and family? This is by Larson and colleagues. There is a visual summary and a commentary. So as always, you don't just have to take my word for it, although you should. So this is a study looking at, well, really discussing non-fusion versus fusion surgery, talking about vertebral body tethering and other non-fusion techniques for pediatric scoliosis that are increasingly gaining popularity. there is a trade-off that includes appearance and preservation of spinal motion, but then that goes against, you know, reoperation rates and the need for further surgery down the road, potentially also failures. So this is a group of researchers, essentially under the umbrella of the HARM study group, that recruited patients and families from 7 pediatric spine centers to complete a survey-based choice experiment jointly developed with the FDA to evaluate patient preferences. So really interesting on that front, a novel research approach developed with the FDA. It includes, I believe, you know, individuals from the Mayo Clinic, New York City, San Diego. So, you know, covers the geographic scope of the United States, but at the same time, these are individuals who are coming to, you know, very high performing centers, and their familiarity and how savvy they are in terms of information may be colored as a result. But they were looking at attributes including appearance, confidence in the correction, spinal motion, device failure, reoperation, recovery. This was patients spanning ages 10 to 21. With adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. Now, here's something that's interesting. It was if they were considering or who had already undergone treatment with fusion or non-fusion. And then they used preference weights as part of their methodology approach, which is fine. They have 344 respondents, 124 patients, 92 parents, and 128 parent-patient dyads that completed the survey. 173 patients were enrolled prior to the surgery. 171 were rolled after the surgery. So you get some real interesting input. The most important attribute for patients who are considering surgery before they had it was preservation of motion and appearance. This is not a spine space that I work in. It's obviously more in the pediatric realm, and you work with adults, seasoned adults, and not children. Well-seasoned. you know, I don't think that there's a whole lot that comes out of this that isn't sort of already implicitly understood in the discussion between, you know, what trade-offs and outcome are acceptable. You're not really defining that. You don't have a threshold to define that. You did a survey and you're talking to people and you're understanding the balances of why they might value the non-fusion surgery versus the fusion surgery. Overall, I think that the findings are like if you wrote a book chapter on why you would value non-fusion versus fusion, that's the things that were found, you know, in this paper. The conclusion that patients and families seeking treatment for idiopathic scoliosis value appearance and preservation of spinal motion, and to a lesser extent, reoperation rates, well, I mean, what else are they going to value? Like those are the things that everyone is concerned about, whether, you know, they're concerned about spinal motion and cosmesis, et cetera, if they're having a fusion. And they're probably concerned about that if they're not having a fusion. And they're concerned about reoperation for both. It just may be one is more likely than the other, but you have reoperations and complications after fusion-based procedures. So, you know, I think the novelty here and the interesting is more around the design and the interaction with the FDA. When you consider the fact it's 344 respondents, about half of whom had already had the surgery, their responses are going to be, no matter what, they're going to be colored to some degree by their experience with the surgery. And that's not something that was really gone into. You know, I would ask you just, I mean, again, it's not the space that you work in, but why not be an armchair quarterback? You know, like based on everything that you've heard, how would you think this would change practice if you think it would change practice? I don't think it would change practice to just kind of put it out there.
I agree. I don't think it'll change practice. I think it's just something to publish results on things that people kind of already look for, right? So it wouldn't change what I would do or what I would look for. Let's say I had a kid who needed to undergo procedures, right? And what I would want to facilitate or what I understand, but not a change, but just understanding or verbalizing what I'm thinking.
I think it's been a year since we brought up Jackie Chiles, but I'm going to put this in the Jackie Chiles bucket. This is getting the Jackie Chiles soccer red flag. Red card, rather.
Red card. Red card's not a yellow card or red card. Okay, there it is.
Yeah, just because, like, you know, it's a lot on the advertising, a lot on the, you know, this is like how important this is, and they tell you that they're going to help you understand patient and family preferences, and, you know, how these things drive these choices. But I don't think it really does that. I think it's just kind of a catalog. At the end of the day, you're just sort of left with, okay, you told us what half the patients already had the surgery. So they're telling you in retrospect how they remember they thought about it.
There you go.
It's tough to get excited about that one in the new year. I mean, I'm just...
Yeah. And the hard part is it's all retrospective and it's all recall, right?
Well, not for those who are... For half. For those people who are yet to have the surgery, that's right. Probably a lot more accurate. Yeah. They're telling you in real time, essentially, what they're how they're thinking about the procedure.
There. Makes a lot of sense.
All right. So now on to what you've selected. Always an interesting discussion around tranexamic acid. Not as controversial as it used to be, I don't think. But tranexamic acid is safe in patients with a history of venous thromboembolism undergoing total joint arthroplasty. I feel like we've heard this story already before. It's deja vu all over again, like Yogi Berra says. This one is by Richardson and colleagues. There is an infographic. So tell me if I'm right or wrong, controversial or not. Discuss.
The first thing I have to say is it's an age-old question. Who is safe to receive tranexamic acid prior to total joint arthroplasty? So you are correct. This is not a new view. I guess what makes this new is using a really large database with lots and lots of patients and looking not at just high-risk patients, but they define high-risk patients as a patients with history of venous thromboembolism. So those were patients who had previous PE or DVTs. So in the beginning, when we first started using TXA, there was a laundry list of exclusion criteria, including, you know, color blindness, MI, any cancer, basically a huge list to exclude patients from getting TXA. And then as time passed, they flipped to the other side. They basically said anyone can get TXA. So this study is really looking at patients who have a history of venous thromboembolism. But in theory, TXA exhibits antifibrillinogenic effects by blocking lysine binding sites on plasminogen molecules, which inhibits the interaction of plasminogen with foreign plasmin and fibrin, which can increase the risk of clotting. For those who are taking OITEs, you're welcome.
I think congestion in the antrum of Highmore was a disqualifying factor for TXA use at one point. It may be okay now, though.
Or now still could be.
Yeah. Oh, that one might still be a no-go.
Still might be a no-go. I'm just saying there's a lot out there, depending on your anesthesiologist, that I can say. So high-risk patients are those who had increased risk of thrombosis. So they wanted to see if you can use TXA in these patients, and they did stratify it by oral versus intravenous. They used the Premier Healthcare Database from 2015 to 2021. So they had over 70,000 primary elective total hip and total knee patients with the history of thromboembolism. They also did compare with hips versus knees, and they found actually no difference between hips versus knees. The primary endpoint was 90-day risk of thromboembolic complications, including pulmonary embolism, deep vein thrombosis, stroke, and myocardial infarction. And there were a bunch of other secondary endpoints, including bleeding-related complications, infection complications, wound, and medical complications. And again, this is with 90 days. They also looked at 90-day readmission and in-hospital death. They did univariate regression analysis followed by multivariate regression analysis to address potential confounders, including the hospital characteristics, in-hospital venous thromboembolism, chemoprophylaxis, and patient comorbidities. So in this database, 65.1% of these high-risk patients received TXA, and 35% or 34.9% did not. So it wasn't an even split, but it was a pretty decent split given the patient population here, because I know in some hospitals, they will absolutely not give TXA if there's a history of VTE. So patients who received tranexamic acid had significantly shorter length of stay at 1.85 days versus 2.15 days for those who did not receive TXA. However, high-risk patients who received TXA were less likely to have a history of cerebrovascular accident, coronary artery disease, and a presence of a coronary stent or peripheral vascular disease. Patients who did receive TXA had a higher rate of obesity, interestingly enough. Patients in TXA cohort were also more likely to receive apixaban, aspirin, or dalteparin compared to those who didn't have TXA. So looking at just the univariate analysis, those who received TXA had lower rates of pulmonary embolism and deep vein thrombosis compared with patients who did not receive TXA. And bleeding complications, including acute blood loss anemia or blood transfusion, were also lower for those who received TXA. Not surprising. Medical complications such as pneumonia, respiratory failure, acute renal failure, urinary tract infection were lower than those for those who received TXA. And they also had a decreased risk of sepsis, although there was no difference in the rate of PJI. Doing the multivariate analysis, when they control for confounding factors, patients in the TXA cohort had a similar risk of pulmonary embolism, but what they did found was a decreased risk of DVT, even though these patients received TXA. They had no differences with regards to stroke or myocardial infarction. Not surprisingly, patients who got TXA had less risk of acute blood loss anemia and blood transfusions. And those who received TXA had less risk of transfusion and 90-day readmission. So the take-home message is it's safe to use TXA in patients, even though they have a high risk of thromboembolism because they had a previous history of thromboembolism. We don't know how long ago they had these thromboembolic events, right? Was it the day before? Was it from another surgical procedure unprovoked? Did they have factor V Leiden? Things like that. But they did see, interestingly enough, less DVT in the TXA group, even though it's more of a thromboembolic generating agent. So use TXA. Probably not a game changer of a study, but in a patient with a history of thromboembolic disease, if your anesthesiologist is pushing back against you for using TXA, you can say, please use it now.
But I mean, I think that's very telling that what you just said about the VTED rates. Let's revisit that one more time.
VTE rates were, PE rates were the same for patients who received TXA, but decreased risk of DVTs.
So giving patients TXA decreases DVTs.
That doesn't seem to make
sense. It doesn't make sense. And why doesn't it make sense? Because of, say it with me, everyone, selection bias.
Yeah.
Okay? You would not expect, knowing the mechanism of TXA, that if you give TXA to patients, they're going to have lower rates relative to the group that doesn't receive it. That is a selection bias. The people who are not getting it, there's a cohort of patients in that cohort that you're not going to be able to discover because of the nature of this, you know, claims warehouse registry that Premier Healthcare, Pearl Diver, Mariner, or the Infomart, you know, any of these kinds of registries, they cannot effectively unpack selection and indication bias. But that is an absolute exemplar. That is a finding that you cannot explain. If we did a randomized controlled trial and just gave TXA to everyone, knowing the mechanism of action of TXA, the people who get it should at least have some degree of a higher rate. Whether it's marginal, whether it's not significant, that's fine. But when you're seeing the reverse, especially in something like this where it's prone to a decision-based bias, you know, that's a fundamental issue. And what it is showing is that, you know, despite the X million number of patients that are included in this and their statistical approaches, someone had mentioned to you they wanted like statistics corner, you know, be careful what you wish for. So here you go, buckle up. Here's the statistics corner. Like when you're talking about bivariate, they say univariate. When you're comparing two variables, an outcome and a predictor, then you have the multivariable analysis. If you're even showing the bivariate results, that's just for transparency. None of that is useful in terms of informing care. You want the adjusted analysis. But their adjusted analysis cannot adjust for confounding by indication. What you would need is like some kind of propensity score study, ostensibly. And even then, I'm not sure that you can get at real selection bias around the decision for TXA. You could do a better job than just a regression. But yeah, I mean, Rand Schwarzkopf and colleagues from NYU, they had a study like this just on their own data that was published in NYU specific data that was around, you know, the risk-based analyses. Like we've heard this story. Now we've heard it. Do I think TXA is safe in patients with, you know, theoretically higher risks or some type of history? Yes, I think that this is showing this, but it's not showing it for all patients because the patients who are probably at the highest risk are the ones not getting it, or at least a sizable proportion are the ones not getting it. And that's, I can't prove that except to say that that what we just discussed doesn't make sense exactly. But just the way that I can't prove it, you can't prove the reverse either. And my explanation is more plausible than the explanation that TXA lowers your risk of VTED.
Totally agree. So case on hold?
I mean, I think it's very borderline. Like, I don't disagree with their conclusion, but I think they're, you know, they have this new idea of like a type 3 error, which is like the right answer for the wrong reasons, right?
Yep. Makes a lot of sense.
All right. I think we'll just leave it at that.
Agreed.
All right. So on to the actual case that we'll be putting on hold in the featurette. This is Precision or Pitfall, Evaluating the Accuracy of ICD-10 Coding for Cemented Total Hip Arthroplasty, a multi-center study by Singh and colleagues. So this is more of kind of a higher level sort of thought experiment, kind of methods background heavy study rather than like a hypothesis-driven clinical investigation, practice-changing investigation type work. This group wants to evaluate the accuracy of ICD-10 coding for identifying, in this case, cemented fixation and primary total hip arthroplasty. But I'd say this is a canary in the coal mine. It's a test case. Like, you know, conceivably, if coding accuracy for this is maybe not so great, then, you know, maybe it's not for a variety of other codes. So they reviewed all cemented primary total hip arthroplasties performed at 4 academic medical centers between October 15th and 2020. And they provide an assurance here that these centers were heavily invested in getting coding right. Vigorous institutional commitment, they call it, to optimized coding among the institutions that were studied. So everyone here was presumably really into getting the coding schemes correct. I'm not sure why exactly, but
you know, coding comes with a few things. One, coding is good for research, right? So if you incorrectly code something, that's problematic, and you try to follow.
But if you don't do research, you don't care about that at all.
Unless coding can affect your bottom line, that's another.
Yes, then that is very true, and that's probably the number one motivating factor in terms of people getting coding correct. However, if I get paid the same, whether I use this code or that code, and I don't really care about, you know, people doing research because I don't value it, then it doesn't really make a difference to me. If I'm going to get, if there's payment parity across a number of available codes, just like, yeah, whichever one I know off the top of my head, or, you know, the reality is a lot of this coding is now outsourced to, we'll call them civilian, really non-medical, like non-medical coders, people who do not have an MD, people who do not do the procedure. A lot of times, even the individual doing the procedure, they'll put in the codes and then somebody else comes behind and like says, no, this is going to change to this or this is going to change to that. And sometimes there's a lot of different reasons for it, some of which are not valued by the person doing the coding themselves, meaning the person performing the procedure, and some of which are just, you know, I've had plenty of codes where I've gone back to the person who's in charge of coding and I say this, you know, I coded it correctly. You guys decided behind the scenes to change it. And then they'll say, oh, we changed it because of this. And I'll say, well, that's not right. That you made an assumption that's incorrect. And then they'll say, oh, okay, well, okay, we guess we have to change it back. But a lot of people don't spend their time looking at codes the way I spend my time looking at codes.
Why do you change the codes?
Why do I change the codes?
Yeah. What's your drive for going there and changing the codes, like you just said? For research purposes, accuracy purposes?
Accuracy, auditing, and payment.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
So maybe the reasons that everyone to. So if you're listening to it and you're either a future coder or a current coder, these are good reasons to get it right.
So getting into, you know, what they found, they had 552 cemented total hip cases, of which 452 were correctly coded, and that's about 82%. I think that the, you know, going rate for accuracy, like the published rate of accuracy for Medicare codes, not that this is specifically Medicare, but just because they're the largest and probably the most studied, it's somewhere in the range of like 85 to 90%. So this is a little bit lower than that, but in the ballpark, they also have like a sample that's actually not that impressive. It's just 552. Like, so if you do a 95% confidence interval around that, you're probably getting into the upper bound anyway, is probably going to be in the 85% range, right? Mm-hmm. So I think this is aligned with sort of what is known. And, you know, some of the institutions were better than others. If you look at institution B, they were right there at 85%, 100% at institution D. So, you know, the advertised vigorous investment in coding accuracy, I'm not so sure when you have some that are at 72%. Right. So I guess, you know, vigorous is, it depends on all what your definition of vigorous and commitment is. So, I mean, really where what this wraps up with is that their findings reveal existing discrepancies within multiple institutional data sets. This can lead to inaccurate reporting in registries. They specifically name AJRR. And then, you know, they advise caution when utilizing ICD-10 procedure codes to evaluate specific details from administrative claims data. Okay, but what's the alternative? It's like when patients come into my office and they tell me, don't get old. I always tell them, like, well, I like that better than the alternative. Unless you've got the, you know, you've discovered the, my ancestor, Ponce de Leon, tried to find the fountain of youth and he didn't find it. So
I'm still searching.
I'm still searching.
So, yeah, fair. So what do you think about the thing you put on hold?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, basically from root and stem, it's all going on hold. First off, this is something that's well known to people who work in health services research. Like, they're going to be coding errors.
Yeah.
They're going to be coding errors that you can't even anticipate as being the coding errors. You have to accept it as, like, ultimately, it's like we've said from go. This is research. It's a when you're talking about claims-based data, the best you can come to is a simulation, right? That's why it's level 4 and level 3 and not level 1 evidence. So coding errors are known. These are coding errors from 4 particular places that are advertised as being heavily invested. I really don't know what that means. I don't say it as, you know, as a euphemism. Heavily invested means that, you know, we're doing research on these particular aspects, so we have to make sure that the coding is absolutely right. When you get all sorts of other reasons for doing coding that have nothing to do with research, just it's like filling out the prompt stuff. I'm sure that all the people listening who work at any major medical center, just as we do, you have the prompts. They're handing out the prompts in the iPads and, you know, getting people to type in their prompts. If the provider isn't invested, if the patient isn't invested, and it isn't fundamentally informed by some type of deliverable, you're going to have reporting errors. The patient says, I don't want to do it. The provider says, that's fine with me. I don't want you to do it. Like I don't want you to spend the time doing that instead of talking to me. To do real high quality research, you have to be invested in every aspect of it. That's a epistemological truth.
True. I think the hard part is really coming down to the research aspect of it is important, and then just making our registries more accurate, right? Because we make decisions and drive, you know, by large data. And if it's not coded well, this is only a microcosm of 4 different institutions. But if
we're with a small number, 552 over essentially 5 years.
Yeah. So you definitely
4 institutions, so like 25 per roughly.
It's not enough, right? And that's
not even one person's practice.
Like, well, for cemented, maybe it is, right? And that's the hard part about it, right? Is that cementing is still not that popular in the United States. But, you know, obviously AJR data is coming back more and more saying, hey, look, we need to cement more total hips. And this is the data that we're showing from. But if we're not coding it well, is that a problem?
And so, they're also talking about ICD-10 PCS, right?
True.
Okay. So when we are coding a procedure, you're using a CPT code, 27130.
Mm-hmm. So they're not using the CPT code, but the CPT codes don't differentiate between.
I understand that, but this is just the example again of like the disconnect between. Sure. So you do the procedure in the OR, you submit the 27130 for the total hip replacement. You like how I know that off the top of my head? I didn't have to look that up.
I don't know any spine codes.
27447. I know all the joint codes. There are only 2 of them, really.
Whoa. We do revisions?
No. Not revisions.
Primary. Come on.
Just primary. You got it. So then this is getting translated to an ICD-10 code for the reporting at the hospital level or something like that. And again, I'm just showing that there's not invest, like if it's not going to change the bundle that you're getting paid, whether it's this one or that one, the desire to be accurate is going to be reduced. You get the accuracy is when you say, Dr. Schoenfeld, report this case to us exactly as you did it and fill out the form yourself.
That's true. And that's how the Australian registry does it, right? It's like someone in the OR clicking things, checking things off, and that gets manually like inputted into the registry. And so the data is probably more accurate, honestly, when it comes to that. And then they can draw really nice conclusions from it. So
only the Wakanda Total Joint Registry can pull the data from the central servers for Wakanda and get absolute 100% fidelity in the reporting.
That's because they're using the aluminium implants?
Adamantium.
You're right. So much to learn.
All right. It's an odyssey. Every episode is an odyssey. All right. Let's go into the honorable mentions. Younger patients undergoing total ankle arthroplasty experience higher complication rates and worse functional outcomes by Anastasio and colleagues. This study is looking at the records of over 1,000 patients who underwent primary total ankle arthroplasty. They have broken down into age groups, less than 55 being the younger cohort, and then comparisons across these groups. They advertise this as a study that is able to reveal age-related impacts on outcomes after total ankle. They believe the study is the largest single institution series evaluating the effect of age on outcomes after total ankle, and younger patients had higher rates of complications and implant failure. So that's something of interest. And it has a commentary, and 30 days free. So then we have measuring value in spine care using the PROMIS preference scoring system. We just talked about PROMIS. This is from Skolaski and colleagues at Johns Hopkins. They have close to 1,000 patients. We're just on that, like, if you get to 1,000, it's a good article for JBJS, I think. They want to assess construct validity, correlating the PROPR score with the neck disability index. They ultimately conclude that this PROMIS preference, that's the PROPR score, is valid and responsive preference-based assessment, health utility for patients undergoing spine surgery, and can be calculated from PROMIS outcome data. So definitely interesting work for those who are looking to do more research or use that as an outcome measure in the spine surgery space. Then we have establishing consensus on essential resources for musculoskeletal trauma care worldwide, a modified Delphi study by McKechnie and colleagues. This is permanently free. They used the modified Delphi method with 3 rounds of electronic surveys among participants identified with use of the AO Trauma, AO Alliance, or OTA, and European Society for Trauma and Emergency Surgery Networks. They have 103 participants of 111 invited surgeons. And overall, there's agreement on a core list of essential musculoskeletal trauma care resources, among other factors. There are a number of different factors. They maintain the study represents a first step toward establishing international consensus. They utilize the Delphi method to support this, but it does not examine patient management. And, you know, the clinical relevance, I think, is more in the exploratory realm than it is in the actionable one. That is where we're at. We're already out of time, if you can believe it. We're, you know, 2 days into the new year and we're already out of time. For those of you who have stuck with us for 3 years or possibly just 30 minutes, we appreciate it. And for those who like what they heard, you know, make sure you tune in again in 2 weeks. For those who didn't, give us a try again in 2 weeks. Maybe you'll like what you have to hear then. We're about out of time. We'll try and do better next time. Hopefully everyone are already off to a great new year. We wish you all the best in this 2024 and prosperity, happiness, health, all cases on green. But when you come here, your case will still be on hold.